Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and you're listening to Words on Film on WBCALP Boston. I will be reviewing some of the newest movies out right now. For this show, I have three brand new movies to review for you, and one more that I actually saw back in December, and it's been out on Blu-ray and 4K for a while now, for over a month, and I just haven't gotten around to reviewing it until now. I have a couple of films that are like that. It's just with all the new films that are coming out, plus some of my special shows like The Best and Worst of 2023 and the Oscar shows that I had. I had three of them. It just kind of fell by the wayside. But because I only reviewed three brand new films this week, I'm going to get to that one later on the show. However, the first movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Abigail. And this is the latest that is directed by Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillett. And it has an all-star cast. It doesn't have too many people who are acting in it, but the people who do act in it are relatively well known. I mean, it's not an all-star cast like, you know, Ben Stiller and Eddie Murphy are in it. Not quite that all-star, but it definitely has some familiar faces to it. And this is a horror thriller film. And initially, I think probably calling it a horror film would be a little bit of a spoiler. But to my defense, it seems like the people who advertise for this film kind of gave away a spoiler. So I think a lot of people who are going into this film, including some who avoid trailers like I do, probably know the twist to this movie already, in the sense of who Abigail is, whose daughter Abigail is, and also why the supernatural horrific events that are going on in this mansion are happening. But I'm just going to start with the basic plot of this film. It is about a group of seven criminals who kidnap the ballerina daughter of a powerful underworld figure. And once they do that, they retreat to an isolated mansion, unaware that they're locked inside with no normal little girl. So I'm going to give away the middle of the film, shall we say. But as promised, Words on Film has a no-spoiler policy, so I won't give away the ending to the movie. But this movie is scary a lot of the time. It's funny in some unexpected places, and it's actually a blast to watch. Interestingly enough, there was another film that came out last year, which I not only haven't seen, but also haven't seen on the marquee to any of my local movie theaters, and I haven't seen it on streaming either. It's also called Abigail, and it's also a horror thriller film, but last year's Abigail film is about a problematic teenager who makes friends with her tormented neighbor in the 1970s, but her obsession turns deadly when she seeks revenge on those who did him wrong. That's an entirely unrelated film, and it also does not have as many well-known actors in it as this Abigail is. So when we are introduced to the characters here, you actually see Abigail, the titular character here, who's played by Alicia Weir, who is a 12-year-old who is very skilled at ballet dancing. And in fact, the real Alicia Weir is apparently also very skilled at ballet dancing, which is why she was supposed to have one scene where she dances, but she was so good at dancing that the directors decided to give her more scenes. And eventually she goes home to her lavish home, and there are people there to whom were not introduced, at least not at first, who kidnap her. And then they take her to a remote mansion, presumably just outside of Boston. And there's a man there by the name of Lambert, who's played by Giancarlo Esposito, who is telling them what their mission is for the next 24 hours. And what that mission is watch over Abigail, make sure she doesn't go anywhere, and also just don't screw up. There's another caveat. None of the people who participated in Abigail's kidnapping can know who each of them are. So all of them are given aliases. And for those of you who are familiar with the Rat Pack, you probably can tell some of these names. So there's one guy who's named or nicknamed Frank, another named Dean. There's a girl who's named Sammy.
a guy named Peter, a woman named Joey, and there is also another guy who's probably the odd person out, and he's given the name Don Rickles or Rickles. And all these actors are played by Dan Stevens, Angus Cloud, Catherine Newton, Kevin Durand, Melissa Barrera, and William Catlett, respectively. And they all have their unique personalities. As a matter of fact, Angus Cloud is competent in his driving abilities, which is how they're able to escort Abigail to this remote and dilapidated mansion, but he's also relatively unreliable when he's just by himself. In other words, he's a druggie. And this is actually Angus Cloud's last film. The film is dedicated in his memory because last year he sadly died of a drug overdose. I won't get too into that, but he's probably one of the characters who sticks out the most. However, the character that you probably know the best is the one who is named Joey. That's not her real name, but that's the name that Giancarlo Esposito's character gives her. And she's played by Melissa Barrera. She's the one who actually watches over and checks in with Abigail as the kidnappers are just lounging in this mansion and keeping a watch out. And then eventually things go really wrong when various kidnappers here end up dead. I'm not going to tell you who dies. I'm not going to tell you how they die, but their deaths are horrific and surprising. And I said previously, like during last week's show, when I mentioned the movie, The First Omen, is the sign of a good movie is when I am compelled to take my hands and put them up against my eyes and kind of looking out through the slits in my fingers. Well, I found myself doing that quite a bit during this movie. And Abigail, just a little bit of a spoiler alert, is not only the daughter of a criminal underworld figure, she's also a vampire. And yeah, it seems like the younger and the smaller a person is, the scarier they are when they become a monster. And Alicia Ware is certainly no exception to that rule here. And I also thought they gave her a lot of great characterization when not only is she horrific as a vampire, but she also knows how to play with the minds of the kidnappers who are watching over her as they are trying to do their job before Giancarlo Esposito's character Lambert comes back. Now, I'm not going to tell you who the actor is who plays Abigail's father. In fact, I might have revealed that in last week's What's Coming Up Next segment. But I will say that the kills in this movie are horrific. And also, the way that the certain vampires die in this film is also a lot of fun. As a matter of fact, the directors of the film, who again are Matt Bettinelli, Open, and Tyler Gillett, said that they were actually inspired by a film called Hide and Seek, which came out 5 years ago. To Abigail's credit, Abigail is a lot better a movie than Hide and Seek. And Hide and Seek came out in the summer of 2019. I did see it. I did review it for this film. It was actually one of the last movies that I reviewed before leaving Boston and taking the show with me. And that one, I think, is just one of those redundant, cliched horror films where they take an innocent child's game and turns it into a horror film. But Abigail may have a child in it, but unlike Hide and Seek, it's not childish. It's not childlike. It is both scary and fun. And it's the reason that I give Abigail my rating of a knockout. It is a film that is a lot of fun to watch. I think that the actors are excellent in it, especially Alicia Ware and Melissa Barrera. But honestly, all of the actors, when they're in the same room together and they're interacting, whether they're just getting to know each other or whether they're banding together to survive, they do an amazing job with what they're given. And the ending to the film also has some great kills, an amazing climax, and the resolution to the movie is also both fun and kind of understandable given the context. So Abigail is a win for me. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which has a very ironic and sly British title to it. It is, after all, a British movie, and not just because it is directed by Guy Ritchie, who is a famous and well-known British director, but initially, I thought this was going to be tied into the Kingsman: The Secret Service cinematic universe, but actually it isn't. Not only that, but the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is actually based on a true story that was initially top secret, but was declassified in 2016. This movie, by the way, takes place in 1941 to 1942. So why the British government waited over 75 years to declassify this story, I don't exactly know. But even though it's based on a true story, it is a heavily fictionalized version of an operation by the British Army that was known as Operation Postmaster. And this was conducted off the Spanish island of Fernando Po, now known as Bioko, off West Africa in the Gulf of Guinea during World War II. And the mission was carried out by a team known as the Small Scale Raiding Force and the Special Operations Executive in January 1942. Their objective was to board the Italian and German ships in the harbor and sail them to Lagos, where they'd be in safe British seas. And the company that is part of this operation, the small-scale raiding force, which actually would have made a good name for this movie, includes Gus March Phillips, who's played by Henry Cavill, with an epic mustache, I might say, and Anders Lassen, who is a Swedish man, who's played by Alan Richson. And there are other members of this squad, including Jeffrey Appleyard, played by Alex Pettifer, Henry Hayes, who's played by Hero Fiennes Tiffin, and Freddie Alvarez, who's played by Henry Golding. And while this task force, who again is called the Small Scale Raising Force, are going around these seas inconspicuously, posing as a Swedish fishing boat, there are other people who are working behind the scenes to make sure that they can get these boats out of the harbor and into British seas, including one operative named Marjorie Stewart, who's played by Aiza Gonzalez, and another operative by the name of Heron, who's played by Babs Olusanmokin. And overseeing this is a brigadier whose name is Gubbins M., who's played by Cary Elwes. And also, Winston Churchill has a strong supporting performance here, or rather a supporting role here. And in the movie, he's played by a barely recognizable Rory Kinnear. And Rory Kinnear is not as well known to American audiences as he is to arguably British and European audiences, but very much like in the movie Men, Rory Kinnear disappears so much into the role of Churchill that if you see some press photos of him, he is barely recognizable, kind of like Gary Oldman when he played Churchill and won an Academy Award for it. And there's also another supporting performance here played by Freddie Fox, where he plays none other than Ian Fleming, who allegedly took the story of Gus March Phillips and developed it into his most famous fictional character and one of the most famous fictional characters of the 20th century, and arguably the 21st as well, James Bond. So there are a lot of factors that are going on here. This movie is based on a true story, as I say, but it is heavy fictionalized. But as you're watching the film and watching these people carry out this mission, you really don't care whether or not what's true and what isn't, unless maybe you're a World War II buff. But this movie is a lot of fun to watch. I think in particular, Henry Cavill and Alan Richson have a lot of great chemistry together. And the movie is called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. But truth be told, the two of these actors most especially are able to carry out missions where they kill Nazis by the dozen by, oddly enough, even though their kills are gruesome, their demeanor throughout is very polite, almost kind of like Sherlock Holmes. And that's not I'm saying making that comparison, not just because Henry Cavill played Sherlock Holmes in the Enola Holmes movies with Millie Bobby Brown. But yeah, the concept of ungentlemanly warfare isn't all warfare ungentlemanly. It's kind of like saying blatantly obvious. You know, the word blatant means obvious. So when you're saying something is blatantly obvious, you're saying it's either obviously obvious or blatantly blatant. But ungentlemanly warfare, I don't know. It's kind of ironic, and it has that sly British sense of humor, so much so that you would expect somebody from Monty Python to at least make a cameo in this film. Sadly, nobody does, but you're so engrossed in this film and watching these people carry out this mission, you honestly don't care about what this movie could have. And it also made a lot of sense that these small forces would carry out this mission without sinking the ships. And there's an explanation why they take the ships out of the harbor as opposed to sinking them. And the way they do it is definitely worth the watch. And it's also fun to watch them slaughter smug Nazi soldiers by the dozen. And the action moves that they have in this film are very well choreographed. So, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is a great film for people who love action movies, as well as people who love movies that take place during World War II. It's not historically accurate, per se, and they actually have an epilogue where they show the real people who are involved in the mission, who look almost nothing like their on-screen counterparts, especially Marjorie Stewart. The real Marjorie Stewart was not as attractive as Aiza Gonzalez is, but I don't think people would be necessarily disappointed by that casting choice. Either way, every actor in here is well cast based on the strength of their acting, not to mention their ability to carry out the mission that we see on screen. And The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is full of a lot of great action, some appropriate irony, and The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare gets my rating of a knockout. It is a film that is a lot of fun to watch. It is very violent, and if you're turned off by violence, you probably won't like this film particularly, but it's another win for Guy Ritchie, who sometimes, when he directs action films, intersects very confusing plots. In this case, the plot isn't particularly confusing, but it also isn't spoon-fed for it to you, the audience, and I can appreciate that very much. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is Sasquatch Sunset. And this film is classified as an action-adventure comedy, and there are certainly some comedic elements to it, but this movie follows a family of Sasquatches who are colloquially known as Bigfoot, or Big Feet, I should say, and it seems to follow them by way of a documentary style and almost takes the family particularly seriously. But there are some certain comedic elements, but it's not made entirely for laughs. This movie is directed by the Zellner brothers, David Zellner and Nathan Zellner, with David Zellner writing the story and the screenplay for this film. But there is actually no dialogue in this film whatsoever. It's just a series of grunts, and it works particularly well that way. So the only Homo sapien creatures that you see are the Sasquatch family themselves. You don't see any humans. You see a lot of other wildlife like deer, raccoons, and the like. And the movie is surprisingly effective as what is largely considered to be a silent film. Granted, it's not actually a silent film because it has sound effects, but it doesn't have any dialogue. So you consider it a silent film by that regard, but not a silent film the same way as Hundreds of Beavers, which is a film that I reviewed 2 weeks ago. But like Hundreds of Beavers, it certainly has an originality to it and also a poignancy to it as well. Although Hundreds of Beavers was a straight-up comedy, so it wasn't quite on the poignancy side, but the Zellner brothers have directed a number of other films previously and music videos, almost too many to mention, but some of the other feature-length films that they've directed include Kamuko, The Treasure Hunter from 2014, Damsel from 2018, and they also directed a couple of episodes of a TV series that I believe is on streaming right now called The Curse. That could be on Netflix, but don't quote me on that. I haven't seen any of these movies or TV shows, but so Sasquatch Sunset is my introduction to the Zellner Brothers. And I gotta be honest, 2024 is turning out to be, so far, we're not even a third of the year of the way through the year, but it's already turning out to be a year of original independent films. Granted, none of these films have broken any box office records or developed a following quite yet, but I have the feeling that many of them will. I mentioned Hundreds of Beavers previously. Also, Late Night with the Devil, which I reviewed 3 weeks ago, is a film that I will probably never forget. And Sasquatch Sunset also is one of those films that I think will be one of those cult classics. But it takes place in the year of the life of a unique family. It captures the daily life of the Sasquatch with a level of detail and rigor that is simply unforgettable. And interestingly enough, there could have been no-name actors who played the Sasquatches, because the four actors who play the Sasquatch family, who are not exactly credited, I mean, they're given their dues on the screen, but they're not given names or titles. So the actors who play the Sasquatch family are Jesse Eisenberg, Riley Keough, Christoph Zajac Denik, and Nathan Zellner, the latter of whom is one of the directors of the film. And Jesse Eisenberg and Riley Keough are the actors who I probably recognize the most, with Jesse Eisenberg definitely taking first place with a bullet. But when I was watching them on the screen, they didn't look recognizable at all. They looked like what I would imagine a real Sasquatch, if a Sasquatch does actually exist, would look like. And, of course, a lot of conspiracy theories have gone out about whether or not Bigfoot exists. And my take on it is, I don't want to be a skeptic. I don't want to not believe that Sasquatch exists. But if Sasquatch wants me to leave him alone, fine by me. Because I would rather leave Sasquatch alone and know that he exists than go out on an expedition to prove his existence and come face-to-face with him and have him literally tear me apart. But anyway, it's interesting that these actors who are not particularly tall, especially Jesse Eisenberg, who's no more than 6 feet tall, would play a creature that you would imagine would be at least 6 foot six. And maybe the size of the actor who was in the Chewbacca costume, maybe, or the Sasquatch costume in Harry and the Hendersons. But it doesn't really matter. They look big when they're on screen. And they go through a journey, and some of the members of the Sasquatch family die. And there's one member of the Sasquatch family, the only female in the Sasquatch family, who actually gives birth in the movie. And I began to forget that this film is a fictitious account. And as I was getting into the film, it looked a lot more like a documentary, especially the part where Riley Keough's Sasquatch character gives birth. And the Sasquatch baby is absolutely adorable. And I would like to know actually how they created the Sasquatch baby. Did they employ the Jim Henson Company to create it? Was there actually a human being in that baby Sasquatch costume? I don't have the answers for you, but it makes for a great watch. And that's probably the only part of the film that I will technically spoil for you, but Sasquatch Summer is a movie that is very unique. There are parts of the Sasquatch Summer movie that are draggy. After all, there's no dialogue, and a lot of the film shows the Sasquatch family going from place to place and surviving. Some of the walking can be boring, but the parts where they interact with vacant places where humans obviously have been, in addition to trying to survive and trying to save each other, those are very intriguing and in a lot of respects, very touching as well, which is why I give Sasquatch Sunset my rating of a knockout. And there are scenes in this film that are similar, I think, in tone, not to mention in method, to some of the parts that I liked the best of the movie Godzilla X Kong, or rather Godzilla Kong, the New Empire, in the sense that the best scenes in those movies were when the creatures who couldn't speak were interacting with one another and kind of using their own language. And that is certainly true for Sasquatch Sunset. As a matter of fact, I said that Godzilla Kong, the New Empire, didn't even need the human characters necessarily, but they did actually provide a nice touch retrospectively. But Sasquatch Sunset also doesn't need dialogue, and it doesn't even need other real humans other than the ones who are playing the Sasquatch creatures in this film. Overall, it just tells a good story, and it doesn't need words to do that, and I absolutely respect that. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is The Color Purple, which came out in theaters, the remake, that is a musical remake. It came out on theaters on Christmas Day, December 25th, 2023. And it is a film that I saw around the time that it first came out, but I didn't actually get to review it for you until now. It is, of course, based on the 1982 novel of the same name, written by Alice Walker. And I guess you could call it a remake of the 1985 film that's based on the 1982 book, but the movie actually emphasizes in the very beginning that it is actually directly based on Alice Walker's novel, not so much on the movie directed by Steven Spielberg. And The Color Purple not only was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, it also has stood the test of time surprisingly well. Interestingly enough, The Color Purple is tied for the 1977 film The Turning Point for the most Oscar nominations of any film without a single win. However, interestingly enough, The Color Purple was nominated for Best Picture in 1985, losing to Out of Africa. And I know more people who have seen The Color Purple than have seen Out of Africa. I'm a film buff, and I have never seen Out of Africa. I have, however, seen the original Color Purple twice, and I've seen parts of it other times, but it's interesting that The Color Purple has stood the test of time as well as it has, and despite the particular controversies of Alice Walker, which I won't get into right now. So this 2023 movie, even though it is more of a remake of the hit Broadway musical show that is based on directly on Alice Walker's 1982 novel, it is taking a risk being technically an indirect remake of a film that is regarded as a modern classic. But it is coming out 38 years after that film. So I'd give it a, I always give movies a chance, and this movie is certainly no exception. As a musical, it is excellent. As a musical that is based on a Broadway show, it has a lot to live up to, but I think it lives up to the auspices of the original. And as a remake of a beloved Academy Award nominated film, it also holds its own. And interestingly enough, many people who were involved in the original 1985 film serve as executive producers here, including Steven Spielberg, who I said directed the original, Quincy Jones, who wrote all the original music for the original, and Oprah Winfrey, who not only produced the original, but she also co-starred and was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for the original. So I'm going to try to not make as many comparisons between this film and the original, but it's really hard to do. But the movie largely sticks to the story that we're familiar with in the original film. And I would say also the novel, but the truth is I haven't read the novel yet. Please don't judge me. But anyway, it does take place at the turn of the century, at least at first. It starts out in 1909 Georgia, where teenager Sally Harris lives with her sister Nettie, and abusive father Alfonso. Her mother died some time ago, after which Alfonso started raping Sally, and this causes her to become pregnant twice. Yeah, it's pretty awful. And then when Sally gives birth to her second child, Alfonso takes the child away as he had done with the first. He then forces her to marry a local farmer and a father of three, Albert Mr. Johnson. And I could mention the cast of this film. For example, the young Sally is played by Felicia Pearl Mapasi, and Sally as an adult in the original film was played by Whoopi Goldberg. In this film, she's played by Fantasia Barrino, who also originated and excelled at playing Sally in the original Color Purple musical on Broadway. As a matter of fact, she did that after winning first place in the third season of American Idol, and she's probably best known for playing Sally, and it's great to see her play it in the film version as well. Sometimes when the original Broadway actors play their on-screen counterparts in the film adaptation, it's kind of hit or miss, but Fantasia fortunately hits here. And she has a friend and a confidant by way of Shug Avery, who is a famous jazz singer who started out in this rural Georgia town only to become bigger as she moved to Chicago. And she's played here by Taraji P. Henson. And Taraji P. Henson stands out incredibly well here. And Sally also has a confidant by the name of Sophia, who's played by Danielle Brooks. And Danielle Brooks is actually the only actor in this film to be nominated for an Oscar for best, well, for anything, but also for best supporting actress. She didn't have any chance to win against Divine Joy Randolph in The Holdovers, but Danielle Brooks is an amazing presence in this film. She has, very much like Fantasia and Fantasia Barrino and Taraji P. Henson, a very tough act to follow compared to the original film, especially since she's playing a role that was originally played by Oprah Winfrey. But Danielle Brooks does amazing in this film. And I've been a fan of Danielle Brooks ever since I saw her in Orange is the New Black. And I don't talk about a lot of TV series that I've seen, but I was on board with Orange is the New Black from the time it premiered as the second Netflix original series ever to the time that it ceased making new episodes. And Danielle Brooks was one of the great standout actresses on that show. And also the abusive husband of Sally, Albert Mr. Johnson, who is played in the original film by Danny Glover, is played here by Coleman Domingo. And Coleman Domingo is now a bit more of a household name, particularly because he was not nominated for this film, but he was nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role this past Oscar season, having played the organizer of the March on Washington in the 2023 movie Rustin. He played Bayard Rustin. And that's another film that is on Netflix, but I haven't gotten around to seeing that yet. So The Color Purple, this movie, is not as rough around the edges as the original 1985 film. I think that without being exploitative, the original 1985 film definitely focused on some of the harsher aspects of Sally's life and also her terrible father and terrible first husband. And it details the trials and tribulations a little bit more in a raw sense than this version of The Color Purple does. But that doesn't necessarily make this remake or this musical adaptation a worse film. As a matter of fact, there were some scenes in this film where there was music that made probably the hardest parts of this film a bit more digestible than the original 1985 film. So I wouldn't exactly say that the musical adaptation, which I'm reviewing right now, is necessarily better than the original, because the original is a tough act to follow, but it does complement the original very well. And the singing in this film is amazing. The choreography, especially with Taraji P. Henson, and particularly there was one scene where Taraji P. Henson's character, Shug Avery, is arriving ceremoniously on a boat to the local rural Georgia hangout on the river. And the way she emerges into that hut is probably one of the best scenes in this film. And I've only mentioned a couple of the actors who are in this film, and I think all the actors do well, but I mentioned the lead actors. I should also mention Corey Hawkins, her, Halle Bailey, Louis Gossett Jr., God rest his soul, John Baptiste, Anjani, Ellis Taylor, David Alan Greer, Dion Cole, I should say, and also a cameo by Whoopi Goldberg, who plays a midwife. All of these actors are amazing, and it's great to see them just playing off each other so well. And I think one of the other memorable musical numbers was when Shug Avery takes Selly over to the music house, and you actually see what Selly is imagining what a better life would be. That's probably one of the most poignant moments of this film. And I could pick this movie apart and tell you exactly why this film works as a musical, but I'll just say that the musical adaptation of The Color Purple, I'm a little late to get to it because the physical media has already been released for this film, but this musical adaptation of The Color Purple gets my rating of a knockout. I would not go as far as to say it's better than the original 1985 film, but as a musical that sands off a lot of the rough edges, it works very well without compromising its artistic integrity. And Fantasia Barrino does extremely well adapting the character that she semi-originated on Broadway onto the big screen. She not only sings very well, but she acts very well as well. And the great supporting performances by everyone involved. Of course, Taraji P. Henson and Danielle Brooks make fantastic supporting actresses. And The Color Purple is certainly worth watching if you may not be in the mood for some of the rough parts of the original Steven Spielberg-directed film. But it's, as I said, not better, but it is an amazing film. Welcome back to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. And I've reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show. Three of them were brand new. One of them was one on which I needed to play catch up. And there are still some movies from the holiday season that I've seen, but haven't reviewed on this show yet. One of them is The Boys in the Boat, which I'll probably review if I have a shortage of films later. But the point is, now that I've reviewed all the movies that I have to review for you for this show, it's now time for me to get into my final segment, which is what's coming up next. This is my spoken word preview of movies that are subject to being released in theaters and, if I have time, on streaming for the week of April 22nd through April 26th, 2024. And I'm going to start with the movies that are subject to being released in theaters on Friday, April 26th, 2024. On April 26th, 2024, one of the biggest films that is subject to be released in theaters on that day is a film that's called Challengers. And this is a film about a girl by the name of Tashi, who is a former tennis prodigy turned coach who is married to a champion on a losing streak. And her strategy for her husband's redemption takes a surprising turn when he must face off against his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend. Oh boy. I'm not one to kind of gush on gossip or love triangles, but this plot certainly sounds juicy. And the part of Tashi in this film is played by Zendaya, who I think is a little too young to play someone who is a retired tennis prodigy. After all, she can't be any older than 30. I don't know exactly how old she is, but let me look it up. Yeah, she is 27 years old right now. So a little young to play a retiree, especially when you consider that some real life tennis prodigies like Venus and Serena Williams played tennis well into their 30s. But it does sound like a juicy plot. And Zendaya is taking what I believe is her first lead role in a major motion picture. She certainly played kind of co-pilot to certain people, but especially in the Dune movies. But this is where she is front and center. And this could be a test of how she perseveres as a lead actress. But honestly, even if this film flops critically or commercially, I don't think we're seeing the last of Zendaya, because she is a multiple threat. In other words, she has more going for her than acting, so she's going to be around for a while. But this movie also co-stars Mike Faced and Josh O'Connor. And I can't exactly say I can't exactly say how this film is going to be. As usual, I have to see it to determine for myself. But Challengers is a film that I will most likely see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters nationwide on April 26th, 2024, is a movie that's called Breathe. It is not the first time a movie has been given this basic title, but it is a film that looks to be particularly interesting. It is a movie about an East Flatbush mother and daughter barely surviving in an oxygen-less world who must band together to protect each other when intruders arrive claiming to know their missing father. Very interesting. The movie stars Jennifer Hudson and Kivenzani Wallace, who are an Academy Award winner and Academy Award nominee, respectively, who play mother Maya and daughter Zora. And Mila Jovovich plays Tess, who is presumably one of these quote-unquote visitors. And you also have supporting performances here by the likes of Sam Worthington of Avatar fame and Common, amongst other people. There are some other actors, but I don't know them particularly well, I'm sorry to say. But Breathe is a film that looks interesting. We haven't seen Jennifer Hudson in a movie for a while, primarily because she's been busy as a daytime talk show host. But the fact that she has time to star in a movie, not just be a supporting performer in a movie, and host her daytime talk show, that is really impressive. So Breathe is a movie that I may see. It depends on whether or not it's coming out in a theater near me, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters nationwide on April 26th, 2024, is a movie that's called Boy Kills World, which is a funny name for a movie. Does it have anything to do with the TV series Boy Meets World? Probably not. Does it have anybody from that show who's acting in this film? Probably not. Or at least not that I could see from the roster of actors that are in front of me. But this is a fever dream action film that follows Boy, who is a deaf person with a vibrant imagination. And when his family is murdered, he is trained by a mysterious shaman to repress his childish imagination and become an instrument of death. So the fact that the protagonist is named Boy is part of the reason that this movie is called Boy Kills World. Boy in this movie is, by the way, played by Bill Skarsgård, who played Pennywise in the movie, in the big screen adaptation of It, in addition to It Chapter 2. The movie also co-stars Famke Janssen, Jessica Roth, and Michelle Dockery, amongst other people. And as far as I can see, there are no former Boy Meets World cast members who are in this film. Not that I could see from the roster in front of me. It would be kind of funny, but at the same time kind of gimmicky if one of them showed up. But Boy Kills World is a movie that I probably will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. Another movie that is subject to being released in theaters nationwide on April 26, 2024, is a drama that is called Unsung Hero. And this is a film that is a family drama in addition to having elements of a faith-based film. And it's a movie that follows the Smallbone family, who is a tight-knit, albeit large family, from Australia, as they use their faith to hold the family of nine together by turning struggles into an adventure for their children. And this movie is based on a true story. It's directed by Richard Ramsey and Joel Smallbone, and Joel Smallbone himself plays the part of his father, David Smallbone, who is a big character in this movie. And yeah, the Smallbone is a weird name for a family, but I'm not going to get into making fun of people's last names. I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying that it is an unusual last name. And the reason I don't make fun of people's last names is because when you're like me and you're born with a last name that rhymes with jerk, you learn to be nice really fast. But this is a movie that looks very intriguing, and even though it is faith-based, it looks like it has its heart in the right place. Whether or not that means it's going to be a good movie, I don't exactly know, but it's a film that I will see, and I'll let you know what I think on a future show. It's a film that is about a family that immigrates from Australia to the United States of America, and even though they don't have to get over a language barrier, it's still very tough, I would imagine, to move from one country to another, regardless of whether or not there's a language barrier. And I honestly don't know how people who don't speak English can do it, but they probably have a lot of help. But that is another story for another time. Another movie that is subject to be released in theaters on April 26th, 2024, whether or not it's going to be released nationwide is debatable, but it is subject to being released, that's for sure, is a movie that's called Humane. And this is in the wake of an environmental collapse that is forcing humanity to shed 20% of its population, a family dinner erupts into chaos when a father's plan to enlist in the government's new euthanasia program goes horribly awry, as I imagine it would if you were participating in any euthanasia program, let alone a government euthanasia program. Oy vey. So the star of this movie, who's presumably the father I just mentioned, is played by Jay Baruchel, who is in his 30s, and I obviously he's old enough to be a father, but yeah, and it's quite common for men in their 30s to be fathers nowadays. It's a lot less common for men in their 20s to be fathers, but not impossible, you know, that kind of happens. Other stars of this movie include Emily Hampshire, Peter Gallagher, and Enrico Colatone, amongst others. And this is a film that looks like it is jarring. And even though Jay Baruchel has been in a lot of comedies, including those that were either directed by or produced by Judd Apatow, this movie seems to play it straight. And it may be the first dramatic film other than Million Dollar Baby in which Jay Baruchel has acted, or at least in the lead role. But this is a movie that I might see. It depends on whether or not it's in a theater near me and if I have time. But if I do see it, I'll let you know what I think on a future show. That just about does it for this episode of Words on Film. Words on Film is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures, and I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke, reminding you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at WBCA or the station as a whole. Until I watch a whole bunch of brand new movies, this is Dan Burke saying I'll see you at the movies.